Prime Time replay from Money FM 89.3.
It is the world's biggest democratic election, with almost 900 million of India's 1.3 billion people eligible to vote. It kicked off yesterday and will be held in 7 phases. Votes will be counted May 23rd. Results likely to be clear that same day. India will be voting for a new parliament, which will determine who is prime minister and if the current prime minister, Narendra Modi, will continue for a second term. Some of the main issues raised at this election: lack of jobs, better job opportunities, especially for younger people, farmers' distress over subsidies, and national security. To discuss the Indian elections, we're joined by Sindhupal Singh. He's Senior Fellow and Coordinator of the South Asia Program at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technological University. Welcome. So India previously voted for Modi because they were hoping for development. Share with us your assessment of his performance so far.
I think you're right that the earlier, the Modi wave was basically spurred by people's expectation about development. And also, I guess, there was some amount of fatigue with the corruption scandals that plagued the Congress party in the earlier government. In terms of economic development, I think the Modi government, and especially supposedly he owned this, the demonetization was a huge gamble. And there is an assessment among economists that it didn't pay off. In fact, the pain was much more than the gain. Of course, people who have been supporting the demonetization policy say that this is a long-term thing, that the results will come out long-term. But the problem is that this is an election cycle if you don't get it right. So I think in that sense, that's one problem. The second problem, of course, has been a perennial problem, which is India's GDP figures have been going up, but this hasn't led to job creation or job growth. So the cliche that India's economic development has been a jobless growth continues to plague the Narendra Modi government. His initiative about making in India or make in India hasn't got off the ground. Trying to make India a manufacturing base again, that hasn't got to where he would have liked it to be. So overall, the economic picture does not look very good. In fact, I mean, people who follow the Indian election cycle, the BJP were handed some really bad defeats in areas which where they had a huge amount of vote share in the early election. Rajasthan, for example, stronghold, where the Congress party, which people didn't give much hope for, managed to wrest Rajasthan from there. So again, there was a notion that, you know, the anti-incumbency factor had come in, and therefore the Modi government hasn't really delivered on the economic promises that he made.
So what do you think about the chances of the Modi government? Is there a chance that they will win the second term?
Again, election prediction is a very dangerous thing to do, because most of the time people are proved wrong, especially in the Indian case, where I think in the last election, nobody, no polls, no analysts, no pundit managed to predict the scale of the BJP victory. But largely, if you take a couple of surveys that have been done over since January 2019, it points to a particular conclusion, which is the BJP will not do as well as they did in 2014, but the BJP together with its allies will probably once again form the government of India. We reduce numbers again because it's allies and in. But the problem here, of course, is that the opposition, although it will make gains, it won't make enough gains to unseat the BJP.
You know, you talked earlier about an improvement in the economy not translating into jobs. Can you help us understand the gap between the two?
If you look at India's economic success story, the success story normally lies in the cliches that we hear. It's the call centers, the IT. These are services-driven industries where jobs are not created on the scale that manufacturing creates. So the China economic story was China became the world's factory. Everything that you consume, chances are it came from China. And manufacturing allowed the kind of job creation. India skipped that manufacturing phase. And the services, it was a very highly services-driven economic growth. Again, the problem here is that it doesn't create as many jobs in manufacturing. Modi's idea was that India should be should transform itself into a manufacturing base. Unfortunately, there are a lot of structural factors that lead that impeded this kind of Modi government's attempt to try to make India a manufacturing base and therefore translate that into job growth.
And maybe you can get into the structural factors that seem to hold India back from reaching its potential. I mean, at one time we were talking about India and China and which would be, you know, the next superpower. So what's held India back? What needs to change?
On one level, it's not totally India's fault, because the period in which China became a manufacturing powerhouse is no longer the period we live in now. So relative labor costs, for example, that advantage is gone. Even China's relative labor cost advantage is gone. It's gone to countries which can produce the same good for lower per unit labor cost. I was talking about things like places like Vietnam, for example. So India cannot compete with that. Number two, India has another problem, which is a perennial problem, but it's organized and unorganized sector, and how the labor unions are really strong. And again, that creates a problem about being able to hire and fire, which in a developing economy where certain ventures or certain sectors don't take off, it creates a problem. The third issue, I think, is that India arrived on the liberalization bandwagon much later than China, right? And it hasn't been able to plug into the production networks in the way that China has, because China had at least about a 12-year gain. If you look at 79 as China's opening up, India's opening up starts from about 91 to 92. Right? So again, I think the problem is trying to plug into production networks. And the last issue is, and we hear this a lot of time, it becomes a cliche, but it's true, is the if you don't want to compete at the lower end of the labor market, you want to compete at the middle end, then the quality of the education you impart, we're talking about vocational, for example, engineers. So you hear about employers in India saying they have to retrain engineers who come out of engineering colleges, because that education doesn't allow them to practice what they should be doing. Vocational training as well, the simple things like a mechanic, tool making, all those things are lacking. So those are some of the structural problems that I think impede India in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been mentioning about China. I mean, with the ongoing trade tensions between the US and China, which has obviously led to rising costs, why is India not tapping on the opportunity for its manufacturing market as much and as fast as it should?
So again, When the trade war kicked off, there were people, analysts within India saying that this might be an opportunity for India to get in. But the problem again is that, firstly, production networks don't change overnight. Right? They're quite rigid. And number two, the other problems that India faced haven't gone away. Again, the notion of the training, another big issue which I missed out earlier, was land acquisition. It's a big issue. Mm-hmm. Right? To acquire land in India, the amount of legal obstacles that one has to undergo. And this, you want to create a large manufacturing base, then these things need to happen. One small example, the nano car. Right? The nano car. Right? So the nano car was Tata's way to design the cheapest car. Mm-hmm. Land was acquired, agreed, but then there was a backlash and the farmers say we were, you know, and then the plant had been moved to Gujarat from West Bengal. And again, the problem here, the car then couldn't be produced for the price that and this again, shows how land acquisition and creating a manufacturing base, quite important in a sense. In China, you don't have that problem, in a sense. Yeah.
Well, speaking of land and farmers, Mr. Modi's ruling BJP party has promised housing for all by 2022 and doubling farmers' income. How likely are these promises to be achieved?
If you read what some of the economists have been between India and outside have been saying, I mean, this is it's going to be very, very difficult goal to achieve, because I think both sides are promising. I think the Congress has promised some kind of universal basic income, if I'm not mistaken. And again, I think you're not surprised by the promises made. I find it hard to see how housing for all by 2022. And I think the farmers' distress issue will make a big dent in the BJP's vote share. The Congress has represented the BJP as anti-farmer, correctly or incorrectly, but I think that has managed to, it was going to create some kind of a dent in the vote share for the BJP.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the neighbour, Pakistan. Had the latest tension between India and Pakistan affected Mr. Modi's chances of winning the election or gain more popularity?
If you look at some of the polls done before the Balakot attack and after, they show quite clearly that there's been a surge in terms of the support for Modi after that. And also the BJP then uses this particular incident to make national security the main plank of their election campaign. So obviously there is a discernible jump. In fact, I think before the terrorist attack in Indian Jammu and Kashmir, there was a sense that the BJP were looking really shaky, losing states that they shouldn't have lost, and Modi's popularity going down. So in a sense, it's kudos to the BJP government to translate what could have been construed as a national security failure into something that they've capitalized on and hopefully can translate for the BJP at least into votes.
Should Modi be re-elected, do you expect big changes at the top of the nation's civil service?
I don't think there'll be changes at the top. I think that the changes that the BJP wanted to make, they made in their when they came in. I mean, for example, replacing the Planning Commission, which is a Nehru-era kind of Soviet-style five-year plan, economic plan kind of structure. And Modi replaced it with something called the Niti Aayog. And I don't think there will be much, any more change. I think the controversial changes that they have promised or put in their manifesto, things like removing Article 370 from the Constitution of Jammu and Kashmir, promising to build, I think, the temple. I think those are appeals to a particular part of the electorate. But I don't see changes within civil servants. The Indian civil service, in a sense, as functions as in a sense how the British civil service is supposed to function. It functions independent of the political masters. You dare to do your job and then you carry on doing your job. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, this may be the first time that security is actually more important than other bread and butter issues like job creation. How do you think this election's high importance on security will impact Mr. Modi's chances of being re-elected?
I think I will reframe your question somewhat. I would say that the BJP is trying to make these elections about security. Mm-hmm. Now, whether they succeed or not, we will see when the results come out. Obviously, after the tit-for-tat responses, the security has climbed a bit higher. In fact, some of the polls indicate that before, after these sets of incidences, the people's opinion about what is important has shifted somewhat. So more people are saying, but that does not mean that development is still not the biggest factor for people, right? And demonetization has hit that really badly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the world's biggest democratic election, which kicked off yesterday. We were taking a closer look at India's election, which will be held across 7 phases. And you heard there Sinderpal Singh, Senior Fellow and Coordinator of the South Asia Program at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technological University.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.